This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Not too bad right now, 74 degrees. Tommy Tucker, WWL at 614, highs of 87 today, 30% chance for showers. Then we go into a dry stretch all the way from Thursday to Thursday, highs around 90 degrees and nair chance for showers. So the grass should stop growing, thankfully. Stephen Melnick joins us now, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance, measurements and supply chain designs, and electric vehicles as well. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. Not bad. How about yourself?
I'm all right, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us as always. Tell me about the effect of tariffs on products in the United States, specifically EVs or whatever vehicle or whatever specific products tariffs have affected.
You've really asked a good question because let me go through and unpack your question.
Okay.
The first thing you're going to ask is, let's talk about tariffs and EVs. On that issue, what's happening is EV sales in the United States, if you look at the recent data argues that EVs are, you know, we are seeing an uptick in the demand for EVs. We're seeing the fact that about 10% of cars nowadays are EVs. In fact, if you give me a minute, I read one of those situations where I have the data in front of me and suddenly I can't find it.
Yeah, anyway, happens every day for me, Professor. Let me ask you this. EVs, are we talking about all electric or are we talking about partial?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's get down to the statistics.
Okay.
Right now, there's an indication. If we take EVs and we look at EVs to consist of plugged-in electric vehicles, including battery electric vehicles called BEVs, plug-in hybrids, and fuel cell electric vehicles,
mm-hmm.
we find that since 2010, there have been over 6.7 million such vehicles sold.
Wow.
Right now, in 2024, EV sales reached 1.3 million, accounting for approximately 8.1% of total new vehicle sales. However, what's been happening is we're starting to see that vehicle sales in EVs are slowing. When we look at EVs, the demands are basically, it's diverse. For example, certain areas such as California, Oregon, Washington, the demand is higher. Other areas, the demand is lower. What's of concern of EVs is EVs present an interesting issue. If you look at EVs, if you look at Tesla, for example, in contrast to most other cars that are assembled in the United States, Tesla's kind of an interesting case because over 70% of the parts used in a Tesla are produced and sourced within the United States.
Okay.
So, you know, from a tariff perspective, they're not as sensitive, but they are because they're going to require battery technology, which comes in from China.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening is, effective October 1st, the $7,500 tax incentive that was given for new, EV sales, that goes away.
Starting when, Professor?
October 1st.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And what's happening is that people are now buying EVs in advance of that. If you're interested in buying an EV, now is the time to buy it.
Yeah, you got about 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Huh?
You don't have much time. And on top of that, the lease options are also going to fall off quickly after that. So you've got the fact that EV sales are fairly, in the United States, they're fairly strong. They're going to still maintain, we're going to still see EV sales in the United States. Why? Because the world's going to EVs. Europe is going. China's pushing big time. Petroleum-based energy is going away, so it's going to be inevitable. However, you asked the question about what's happening in terms of tariffs. The tariff initiatives are really having a major impact in terms of the auto trade. They're doing a couple of things. First of all, understand that if you look at most cars which are assembled in the United States, right now, for example, a couple of days ago, I was watching something, I forget where, and I saw an ad from BMW talking about how the fact that there's SUVs, the X1, the X3, the X7, are all assembled in the United States. That's true. But did you realize that over 90% of the parts that are used in assembling that EV in South Carolina, they come in from outside of the United States, so they're subject to tariffs. Mm. So what that means is the transmission, the powertrain, the engine, that comes in from Germany. That's going to be tariffed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened? A couple of things have happened. In the short term, Trump has been very vocal about the fact he doesn't want to see the tariffs passed on. And the car companies in general have been absorbing the tariffs. And the reason that they've been absorbing the tariffs is because they don't understand what's going to really happen in terms of the long-term prognosis. What do we mean by that?
Professor?
Whenever tariffs are often, they're random.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You wake up in the morning and you're wondering which tariff is going to be on. So if you look at the impact right now, most car companies are absorbing it, and the result has been significant loss. Toyota has reported a $3 billion reduction in operating profits. GM, a $4 to $5 billion reduction in operating profits due to tariffs. Ford, $3 billion. Stellantis, $1.7 billion. So in terms of the short term, we're seeing car companies. But
Professor, let me jump in for 1 second. When you say the company absorbed the tariffs, well, the company is not a person. The company consists of stockholders, right? So he's asking the stockholders to, in essence, pay the tariffs or contribute to the U.S. Treasury in the hopes of attracting more manufacturing to the U.S.? Yes?
That's right, but it gets a bit more sophisticated, which means these short-term actions are going to finish. They're going to end sometime soon because right now, the inventory that the car companies have had in the United States, which have been used to offset or buffer against the tariffs because they were built before the tariffs were imposed, they're running out. So ultimately, what the prognosis is, expect to pay more on your car. And the result of that has been we have seen disrupted supply chains. We are expecting the latest thing I saw from Cox indicates that they're expecting the average price of a new car to go from $42,000 to about $50,000.
Well, let me just take a break, Professor. We've got to get traffic in. You'll be with us for an hour. And I also want to talk about the rate on that Hyundai battery plant when we come back because it seems to me that just is the entire thing in one place. It has to do with immigration. It has to do with tariffs. It has to do with American manufacturing. It has to do with who's really working at these plants. And if did these people take, and I know there are union representatives that say these people took jobs that union members should have had, but some people are anti-union because they think they make too much money. Well, if that's the case, then they bring in people that are illegal to take the jobs. You can't have it both ways is what I'm saying. And we'll look at that in microcosm, I guess, when we come back. We're talking to Professor Steve Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management, Michigan State University. He's our EV expert. Any questions, comments, text him in to 504-2601. 870, and I'll pass them along. 621 traffic now, WWL. 627, Professor, we're going to hold off on that battery plan till after the news because I'm going to give you some uninterrupted time on that. Let me ask you this. When it comes to the batteries for these electric vehicles and the materials that come from China, it just seems to me that from our previous conversations, I know that the battery life is how long? 4 years? 5 years?
Yeah, it could be. It's up to 10 years.
10 years. Okay. And after 10 years, then basically if the battery is done, the vehicle is kind of worthless without the battery, right?
That's right. That's one reason why many companies, many buyers are not buying them. They're leasing the cars.
So if that's the case, are we then putting ourselves at the behest of the Chinese 10 years from now for batteries where all of a sudden we have 10% of the vehicles are electric and then China has us over a barrel to say, well, okay, here's the deal. If you want batteries for those cars, or am I making stuff up?
No, you've got a good point. You've also got something that's affecting innovation. Understand, if you look at where cars are, if you look at where the EV is compared to where, let's say, the ICE or internal combustion engine car is, the internal combustion engine car is in the mature phase of the life cycle. It's the technology is understood. We understand what's going on. It's a really well-understood game. When you're dealing with a car, a product in the introductory stages of its life cycle, when it's just rolled out, a lot of things are uncertain. And this is very much the case when you look at EVs. And where most people, most innovation is focusing is on the battery. And on the battery, you're looking at the composition because you're looking at the type of materials it requires. This morning, I was just looking over something, an announcement that came through where somebody was arguing that they're looking at a new technology for building batteries, which is based on sodium, which is much more widely available. So one of the challenges you have is if you are dealing with a product in the early stages, a lot of stuff can change very quickly. To give you an idea, in the early 1900s, when cars were taking off in the United States, if one of the most dominant competitors was the Maxwell, was the Stanley Steamer, which was, it was a steam-driven car. There were also electric cars. So you had at that point different technologies competing, and so ultimately Henry Ford was able to reduce the price and make the ICE car the more attractive option. You've got the same thing taking place in batteries. You know, everyone understands batteries have life. Everyone understands that batteries require resources. They have implications for charging. They have implications for disposal. And there are researchers and companies are, in fact, investing actively to ensure that we can explore alternative technologies. And that's one of the things that presents a problem. Because if you invest or bet on the wrong technology, that investment is useless. So you've got this catch-22 when it's coming into EVs, which is there's a lot of uncertainty. And then you ask the question at the very beginning, what's the impact of tariffs? Well, take the technology in uncertainty, which is a problem of its own. If you talk to GM and Ford, they'll tell you they're not making money on their ICE on their EVs. And then you put on top of that the uncertainty of tariffs. And then you put on top of that what's going on with the ICE, the immigration control enforcement. Then what's happening is you're creating a lot of confusion in the marketplace.
Let me take a break, Professor. We'll pick it up here. We come back and we'll talk about that Hyundai plant as well, because that to me seems like the whole thing in microcosm with people working, that do we have the workers here? If we don't have them, then who do we rely on? If we do have them here, then why didn't we hire them? If we do hire them, then they're going to get union wages. That means we're going to pay more. So if you want American manufacturing, you can have it, but it's going to be at a cost. 6:31, 29 till 7, traffic now, and news all that with Ian Ozan on WWL. 6:45, quarter till 7. Quickly back to Steve Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, done research in strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurement, supply chain designs. We're talking about EVs. Let's talk about the raid on that plant in Georgia. And to me, it's just the whole thing about tariffs and immigration and all wrapped up in one neat little package, because it's the question of if the South Koreans were not there or wherever they were from, if they didn't do the work, could Americans have done the work? If Americans were to do the work, would it drive the price up? And are Americans willing to pay more for that? Professor, the floor is yours. Take me through it.
Okay. Well, first of all, what you're talking about is the raid of the Hyundai plant that took place in Georgia, in a place called Ellabelle, Georgia. What happened was they're building a plant that took the governor of Georgia decades to convince Hyundai to establish an EV plant in Georgia. Now, let me give you what's the background, and I'm going to simply point out a couple of things. Number one, what you've got going on is you've got a cluster, and I'm not going to give you the second part of that word, going on in terms of the government policy, because you've got two different agencies which are working at odds with each other. You've got the tariffs, which are trying to encourage companies to come to the United States, and then you've got ICE, Homeland Security, which is trying to clamp down on the illegal immigrants or people working illegally. If you're Hyundai and you're going to establish a new plant anywhere, one of the measures that companies use is called time to break even, which is how long will it take me to get to the point where the plant's starting to produce, where the revenue I generate from this new facility equals the costs. Essentially, what you want to do is you want to reduce the time it takes you to get the plant up and running. So if you're Hyundai and you're going to be building a new plant in Georgia, that plant's going to be pretty well based on models of plants that you're using in South Korea. So if you want to bring it up, get it up and running, are you going to use American workers who've never worked with Hyundai, who've never worked with EVs, who've never worked with a battery plant, who don't understand how Hyundai does work? Or are you going to bring people over from South Korea to the United States under a work visa? Basically, they were here. Here's what you're going to bring people over, and what you're going to have them do is essentially work on getting the plant up and running. Now, these people are here, and they're not being paid by Hyundai in the United States. It's part of their duties in South Korea. So what happens is they come over here. Their goal is to get the plant up and running as quickly as possible. That's a good thing, because as soon as you get the plant up and running, we can turn it over to American workers. We can start pumping money into the economy. Everything is good. On the other hand, you've got ICE and Homeland Security, which wants to clamp down on illegal immigrants. So you now have them, and they swoop in, and they claim these workers are here illegally. They don't have a work permit. They're not being paid by American companies. They're being paid by their companies back in South Korea.
Let me jump in for one second, Professor. They did not sneak into the country, though. They were brought in by Hyundai?
That's right. They didn't sneak in. They were brought in. You don't bring in 500 people to an area and you sneak them in. It's not like, you know, we hired a couple of 747s and we snuck them under the radar. You know, they're going to come in under regular, you know, they're going to come in here for a certain amount of time.
So I presume this is part of the deal with the governor of Georgia to get Hyundai to locate the plant there?
Yep, because what he did is he got the plant in Georgia, which makes sense since Georgia is close to South Carolina and a lot of production is taking place in South Carolina. It's taking place in Georgia, so you want that to attract companies. Makes sense. So what happens? Then ICE comes in because of a complaint, and they basically take all the 500 workers, and they arrest them. This causes a bit of a foo-fry. It also does some other things. It sends an interesting message to the international community that's interested in investing in the United States. Because if you're investing in the United States and you want to avoid tariffs, you want to get your production up and running as fast as possible. That means you're going to make the plants look as much as they look in South Korea, in Germany, et cetera, which means you're going to get people over here, bring people over here, which can get that plant installed. It takes time to install a plant. If you've ever seen a greenfield operation, which is you've got brand new processes, brand new workers, et cetera, it's an amazing undertaking. It takes time. So what's happening now is you've created a situation. How can we get plants up and running quickly in the United States to avoid tariffs? And how do we do it without bringing in our own workers? And if we bring in our own workers, will you accept the fact that they're not going to be paid by anyone in the United States? It's part of their job responsibilities, part in their original home countries. So how do you manage that balance? And right now, the concern I would have is if I was the governor of Georgia, is Hyundai and the government of South Korea looking at this and saying, I don't know if we really want to carry on. And how the administration handles this is going to be really important, because it's going to be a signal to other countries thinking about locating facilities in the United States. And this is important because, for example, Honda is thinking about bringing over its CRV production from Canada to the United States. So you've got this issue, which is it's a cluster. And this should have been thought out in advance. It should not have been projected, and then we let the pieces fall out.
Let me move on to manufacturing in the United States. And
yes,
I saw a union representative complaining, saying that those jobs should have been held by Americans. So if that's the case, well, somebody's going to have to pay or make up the difference that Hyundai is now paying American workers union wages instead of their paying them, right? So where's that money coming from?
Okay, it's more than that. Let me take you, because what you're really asking is an interesting question. You're right. Ultimately, you want to convert these jobs and have them done by the American workers. Even if they're assembly jobs, they're good-paying jobs. In fact, the administration, the federal administration, looks at jobs in transportation and manufacturing and drugs, because those tend to be the best-paying jobs. They get you the best benefits. They pay the most per hour. The problem we have in the United States is we have a shortage of skilled workers in manufacturing. Now, in order to show you that, let me take you to another project I just finished with a governmental agency. The United States is trying to bring chip production to the United States. And there's an initiative called the DBX initiative I was involved in. And what we were looking at is starting production in certain areas of the United States. Specifically, we were looking at New York, around Rochester and Ithaca. One of the things we found in talking with the startups who had the capability, the technology, in some cases, some really innovative, leading-edge technology which could shake up the industry in terms of chip production, is their major concern was the lack of skilled workforce. And that's not a trivial issue. Mm-hmm. It's been present for a while. The United States does not have a formal structure to convince, to support people who are changing careers. If I look at some countries in Europe, if you decide to change careers because of the economy, because of economic shifts, they will encourage you to do it by not only giving you, and I know in Michigan, for example, if you go into certain trades, Michigan will pay for your tuition. But in many cases, you're dealing with people who have families, they have mortgages, they have debts, they have car payments. So it's not enough to give someone a free education. You've got to support them during the transition. So what you've got going on is we have a changing manufacturing base, which requires new skills on our workforce. The other problem is that the current workforce we have that is appropriate is aging out. When we looked at the Rochester area, we found out that the average age of the workforce was 51 years old.
Hmm.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Does that bother you?
Yeah, because that's pretty close to, you know, maybe 10, 15 more years, and that's it. Professor, we're out of time. I hope you come back, because we could talk about this for 8 hours. Steve Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State. There are no easy solutions to complex problems, and that's what the professor tried to illustrate for us. Thank you for your time. 6:55, 5 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. I wish this was more fun, what we're about to talk about, but it's not. We're joined by Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm all right. Tell me about Social Security. What are we looking at?
We're looking at 7 years. That's how much time the trust fund has left before it runs out of money. In 2032, all of the money in the trust fund will have been spent on benefits over the last 7 years. And what that means is we can only pay as much as we're bringing in. That means a 24% scheduled benefit cut for a 69-year-old that's newly retired today.
Mm-hmm.
For a typical couple, it's about $18,400. And our politicians are doing absolutely nothing about it.
So let me get to the trust fund, because people are confused about the trust fund was rated, the trust fund was not rated. Tell me what the Social Security Trust Fund is, please.
Yeah, so the basic idea is Social Security is a self-funded program. We got payroll taxes that come in and benefits that go out. And when the payroll taxes are more than the benefits, we set that money aside, at least from an accounting perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep track of it. And so we know that in the 90s and early 2000s, Social Security was running a surplus. And so effectively, the rest of government owes Social Security that money back. That's what the trust fund is. It's just it's a promise that the rest of the government will pay Social Security back. And that's what we've been doing. The problem is there's not that much left in the trust fund, and the imbalance between the spending and the revenue is so large that the trust fund's not going to last us much longer.
So what if somebody's thinking, well, why don't the government just print more money and make up the shortfall?
We could. We could absolutely do that. But the U.S. government is already more indebted than any time in its history outside of World War II. We are going to be at record levels of debt in a few years. Interest payments now, interest on the debt, is the second largest government program. It's going to be $1 trillion. We're going to spend more in interest than on defense. We're going to spend more in interest than on Medicare, more in interest than on children. So sure, we could borrow the money, we could print the money, but that would just put us in a deeper hole than the rest of government.
Social Security was never, I don't think, meant to be a retirement program. It was created in the day back when people worked for companies and they had pensions. That's gone away now, the way of 401ks and IRAs and so forth. But a lot of people do depend on Social Security to kind of get by, don't they?
That's right. Look, it was supposed to be insurance in case you made it in old age. And then it was supposed to be part of your retirement. And for many folks, that is. But a lot of people do rely on it for a very large share of their retirement. And that's why a 24% across-the-board cut would be devastating. Instead, what we ought to do is make some thoughtful reforms that, yes, is going to slow the growth of benefits, but can focus it on those that are most able to afford it and in ways that let people make up the money. For example, if you adjust the retirement age for people that are young now, they can change their savings habits. They can choose to work longer. Those are options to offset the cost. Whereas if we wait till the deadline, it's hard to come back from a 24% across-the-board benefit cut that's in effect immediately.
So let's look at the politics of this, because it seems as though you're going to get crucified if you are in office when there's a 24% across-the-board cut, right? So it would seem to me politically the pragmatic thing to do would be, because it isn't future, I hate to say pie in the sky, but it is something that people are looking to, now's the time to say, okay, look, we're going to push your retirement age, make it a little bit higher. There are going to be a segment of people that are caught in that, but how many people really, when, in fact, politically, now's the time to do it and not then? Do you understand the point I'm trying to make?
That's right. I mean, look, the politics is tough because if you act when you're not in a crisis, people are asking, hey, why are you beating me up? Why are you taking away my benefits? But if you wait until the crisis, the size of the change is so large that I think you're going to be in a tough position. So, look, the best time to act was probably the 1990s. Mm-hmm. The second best time to act is right now, because we still have the opportunity to phase things in, to give people some warning, to make some smart changes, and, by the way, to make some enhancements where the program is falling short. If we wait till that deadline, we're going to be in deep trouble.
So what would you phase in? What would that look like?
Yeah, so there are many ways to save Social Security, but I would look at a few areas. First is the retirement age. And look, we're not going to tell somebody that's supposed to retire that next year at 67, instead you got to work to 70. That would be ridiculous. What you want to do is gradually adjust the age.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right, exactly. So people that are in their 20s today, maybe they work to 70 instead of the 67. Similarly, on the tax side, we right now tax wages up to $180,000 a year. We could increase this, but we don't have to increase it all at once. We could increase that threshold 5 or 10% a year so that we're bringing in more money, but people aren't seeing huge surprise increases in their taxes that they're not ready for. There's lots of things that we can phase in, but we lose the opportunity if we wait until 2032.
So anything past $180,000 you don't pay Social Security taxes on?
Right now you don't pay taxes on it, and you don't receive benefits based on that earnings. That's the current rule, and there's a lot of interest in lifting that cap. I think a question is how much and how fast.
Because it would seem as though, again, politically, if somebody's in their 20s and you raise the retirement age to 70, that's a long way away to them. And politically, you don't pay the price for that. And also, if you're making $180,000 a year and you raise the tax 5%, then perhaps you don't get the political blowback from that as much as if you were to cut benefits 24% for somebody that's living on them, right?
One would think. But look, the problem is that Democrats and Republicans like to beat up on each other. And they found the dumbest way possible to protect themselves, which is just say, we're not going to touch the program. But not touching the program is essentially an endorsement of that 24% benefit cut. And I think once the voters realize that, it's going to become an unpopular option as well.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I'm laughing because we do this every so often. And we warn you, and Bill Cassidy, Senator, tweets every now and then, still a problem with Social Security. I don't know if he's doing anything to fix it or if he's getting anybody's attention or not, but we keep telling you this train's coming. 721, traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, about Social Security. Newton's third law of motions. The motion, rather, not to get all physicky here or anything, but for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So let's talk about illegal immigrants and net effect on Social Security. Are they contributors? Are they drained? Is it equal? Tell me about that.
This is a great question. So first, let me say that I don't think we're going to be making immigration policy based on Social Security. No. We're going to be making immigration policy based on our immigration policy.
Absolutely. I'm just curious about the other side of it, though.
With that said, immigrants that come here illegally, and in fact, most immigrants, even that come here legally, are a net benefit to Social Security. And that's for two reasons. The first is they tend to be young, and so they're paying taxes for a long time before they're collecting benefits. And so they're a net benefit today because there's that big lag. But the second is that if you're here illegally, or if you're here temporarily, you're unlikely to be able to collect benefits. And so there's a group of folks that are going to be paying in on the taxes that are never going to receive money back.
So as far as the equal and opposite reaction, would deportation, mass deportation, hasten the timeline on Social Security or not?
Yeah, so actually several things that this administration has done I think are going to hasten the timeline. One we already know about, the One Big Beautiful Bill, advanced insolvency from 2033 to 2032. And the reason for that is basically that right now, we apply the income tax to Social Security benefits, to some Social Security benefits, and we use that money to help fund Social Security. And so they cut the income tax, and that cuts the taxation. The second, as you mentioned, is the immigration changes, both the deportations, but also the tougher border security. That's going to reduce the money coming in. And then thirdly, the tariffs, to the extent that these increase prices without increasing wages, it's going to mean bigger cost of living adjustments and more cost for seniors.
So, again, I think that's a good point you make, that immigration policy should be immigration policy and not based on Social Security. However, again, every action has a reaction, so that mass deportations could hasten the effect of the Social Security cuts or that have to kick in, right?
That's right. And look, one way to think about this is the reason Social Security is in so much trouble is that our birth rate has gone way down. And so we have a lot of people that are of retirement age or approaching retirement age and not very many workers to replace them. And so immigration, legal or illegal, can sort of offset some of that decline in birth rate.
Real quick.
If the immigration goes down.
I'm sorry. I just want to get this in real quick. As we talk about AI replacing people at work, less people working mean less people paying in, and that could be an exacerbation as well, right?
It could. I think the hope is that those that are still paying in would be paying more, right? And so if we get a big, it sort of depends where the productivity boom happens. If it all happens on the capital side, then that's true. We'll have less being paid into the payroll tax, which really is a wage tax. We might collect more in income taxes, but that's not helped with Social Security.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate your time as always. Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We'll continue to talk about it because that's some serious cuts. You're talking about 24% by 2032, maybe even earlier than that. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Laura Harris, Education Policy Manager for Bike Easy. They want to improve bike safety around the city. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWO, getting ready to talk to Laura Harris. Laura Harris, Education Policy Manager for Bike Easy, about bike safety in St. Claude, a dangerous place. But before we get to that, I don't know if y'all knew it or not, but St. Claude was Claude La Colombière from France, who was a Jesuit priest. Did you know that, Laura Harris?
You know, I think I had heard that, but it's been a long time. Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, I mean, all my life I've heard about St. Claude Avenue. I never did know who St. Claude was. I had an Uncle Claude, but I didn't think it was him. Let's talk about Bike Easy. Is there a place, is St. Claude the most dangerous place for bicyclists in the city?
I would say certainly one of the most dangerous corridors. Yes, absolutely.
What is it that makes it so dangerous?
Well, one of the main things here is that St. Claude is a state highway.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, all kinds of traffic. We have big, you know, 18-wheelers. The most recent fatality of a person on bike was at St. Claude and Franklin, where a big truck turned in front of the path of the person biking. So it's, you know, kind of these big trucks sharing the road with, you know, tons of people walking and biking on St. Claude. But there's not any kind of, you know, protected bikeway or much infrastructure to help keep people safe. So it's a combination of a lot of different factors, like, you know, high levels of traffic, a lot of people biking and walking, a lot of people, you know, not exhibiting the most safe behaviors. There's a lot of excessive speeding. You know, the posted speed limit's 35. Certainly people are going much faster than that at nighttime. You know, I've witnessed people going probably close to 70 miles an hour. There's no enforcement on.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar-Free. First-round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce canned flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app, available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of these other issues, like illegal parking in the bike lane, illegal parking in the neutral ground, is a pretty big issue because it's really reducing visibility, you know, for all road users, people having to pull out almost in the middle of the road just to be able to see to cross the street. So it's kind of a few of these factors compounding to create a pretty unsafe situation.
When you have a bike lane that's on a state highway like that, would somebody do better to go on an adjacent street, perhaps, like, I don't know, North Villery or something? I'm looking at the map. I'm trying to figure out a street that runs parallel to St. Claude
Avenue, or North Rampart. A lot of people kind of just don't really have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, if you want to bike a few blocks out of your way, if you have time, but, you know, most people are just trying to get where they need to go. And unfortunately, because of the way that, you know, St. Claude goes through the Ninth Ward, which is cut off, you know, by the train tracks at a certain point, by the canal at a certain point, if you, you know, are crossing any of those things, you're kind of forced to go back over to St. Claude. Cutting over to Rampart Street in the Bywater, you know, is nice if you are going in that direction, but, you know, the fact is that St. Claude, a lot of people's destinations are on St. Claude. St. Claude's home to tons of bars, restaurants, grocery stores, things that people are actually biking to. So, you know, even if maybe it makes sense to go on another street for a few blocks, it might not, because a lot of people are actually going to destinations that are on St. Claude itself. So we really deserve, you know, we feel that St. Claude deserves better treatment for people biking and walking, knowing that so many people are already biking and walking on this corridor.
What's another dangerous area in the city for bikers?
Pretty much any
bicyclists, I should say.
Yeah. We like to say people on bikes just to kind of remind people, you know, everyone's a person just getting where they need to go. St. Claude, certainly a lot of the state highways that traverse through the city don't have great infrastructure. Most of the fatalities of people on bikes have happened at state highways or places where people are crossing state highways. So those also include streets like Claiborne. It's certainly a place where a lot of fatalities happen. People crossing, trying to get across Claiborne Avenue is another big one.
Manhattan on the West Bank too, right? I see ghost bikes there a lot.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we've seen them all over the city.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll talk about what people need to know and what can be done to improve bike safety in the city. Laura Harris, our guest, education policy manager for Bike Easy. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 757, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We like to talk to the people from Bike Easy. Laura Harris, education and policy manager for Bike Easy, to try and make it safe for people on bicycles, also people that are driving, inevitably, whenever we talk to you. Laura, I get texts from people talking about bicyclists driving the wrong way, and what sometimes people don't understand is that not everybody in a car follows the rules either. Thoughts on people getting along and sharing the road? And what the law says as well.
Yeah, certainly. You know, people on bikes fare best when they act as and are treated as drivers of vehicles. You know, so people on bikes, on vehicles too. So, you know, we all have a duty to share the road responsibly. Both people on bikes, people on cars should be following the rules, communicating with each other, you know, being aware that everyone's just trying to get where they need to go. So doing things like using turn signals in your car or using your hand signals on your bike, making people aware of your direction of travel, can really do a lot. You know, people should always be going in the direction of traffic. That's whether you're driving or biking, and doing as much as we can to communicate, being visible, and just kind of being aware of behaviors that people on bikes might do to keep themselves safe, like taking the lane. You know, if you see somebody riding their bike more in the middle of the lane, it's probably because it's the safest place for them to ride. New Orleans has a lot of narrow streets. We have a minimum of 3 feet required for passing a person on a bike by law in Louisiana. So if there's not more than 3 feet to pass somebody, you need to wait until it's time to give them space to be able to pass safely. We teach people on bikes not to ride too close to the right edge. We don't want people to be in danger of a car door opening into the path of someone biking, and we want to make sure people are visible and safe. So that's why you might see people on bikes riding more towards the middle of the lane, or what we call taking the lane. So there's just a few things that people can do. Something that drivers can especially do is always look before you open your car door. Anytime you're getting out, practice using your opposite hand to open the car door. It's going to force you to look behind you to see if anyone's coming. So if you can just do one little thing, just always look before you open your car door to make sure people are safe.
Defensive driving. Thank you, Laura. We'll be back. WWL. 8:15. Now we take our deep dive into crime with Ronald Surpass, our friend, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, and a consultant for crime. You'll see him on TV occasionally, network TV, giving his opinion on this or that. How you doing, Ronald?
Tommy, I am great. How are you?
I am okay. Let's talk about this whole thing with the mayor going into federal court today and Officer Vappy. And you were the chief of police for a long time. How could it have come to this? Should somebody have seen this happening? Or take me through what mayoral protection was like when you were chief.
You know, one of the hardest things about being chief, Tommy, is getting people to just simply follow the rules. You know, you had this big overtime story in the NOPD a few days ago. You had this issue with the guy going to New Orleans East running around with the prostitutes. You have the issue of this horrific tragedy in New Orleans East with the young boy. It's just getting people to do what they're supposed to do. So in a case like Vapi, you have nobody supervising him. Nobody saying, hey, how are you working so much overtime? Hey, why are you the only one traveling? Or why are you traveling on these extra days? It's a matter of just supervision, and it is a, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to admit, but in American policing, we just don't do a good enough job of that. Now, Vapi's, now there are policies that protect somewhat for that. In the police department, when you join, I don't know what it is at WWL, but when you join a police department, and I've been in three and studied hundreds, there's a standard policy that says you are deemed to be knowledgeable all of the rules, policies, and procedures in effect at the time. And you don't get to claim ignorance. You can't claim, I'm just too stupid not to know what I wasn't supposed to do. That's Vapi's huge problem. Whether or not the mayor has some responsibility for playing, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, and all those kind of issues, that's kind of a political question for the electorate. They kept electing her over and over again. I guess they don't care. He's going to have some exposure for sure. But Vapi's serious problem is he cannot claim he didn't know the rules. He cannot claim he didn't know he was supposed to work overtime or not. He cannot claim that he didn't know he wasn't supposed to be having a romantic affair during work hours. He can't claim he didn't know that it was a conflict of interest, for lack of a better term, for having a romantic engagement with somebody he was charged with protection. Vapi is toast, done, and toasted. There's nothing he can say about, I didn't know. He would have to say, I'm too stupid to know how to read, which he can't use as the defense. So that's the big problem he faces. As far as the mayor, I mean, clearly there will be some arguments that she's the chief executive officer of the city. He can probably dance around and complain that, well, because the police department does such a crappy job of supervising him, why am I responsible? Mm-hmm. That's not going to be too particularly successful, because on the outside, it looks like what it sounds like inside of a jury room. I don't know what it's going to sound like, but know this. Vapi cannot claim he's too stupid to know that he couldn't do the things he was doing. He can't claim that with the policies as the way they are written.
Even going inside of a mayor, a protectee's home, unless there's an emergency, that right there should set off a red flag, right?
Well, I mean, in my experience, we provided protection for Mayor Morial when I was the number two chief. We provided protection for Governor Locke when I was the state police chief, Mayor Purcell and Mayor Dean in Nashville, and Mayor Landrieu when I came back. And the unit is generally going to be one that's staffed by people that are comfortable with one another. They're long hours. You need people that you can work with and feel comfortable with. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go inside TD and do the mail and do the wash. That's not what protection is all about. Mm-hmm. So I am unaware of any circumstances where any of our officers during my time as chief, which doesn't mean anything other than I would never happen that I knew of, the intelligence units or some unit like that would generally supervise these people. And I'm going to just be honest with you. We had more trouble keeping troopers on Governor Locke because he wanted time alone. He wanted to be with his family. Mm-hmm. He wanted to disappear on the weekend and take the kids to the zoo. We had the same issues with Mayor Purcell and Mayor Dean, where they wanted time for themselves. They wanted the unit would almost have to say, did anybody see the mayor yet today? And one of the mayors in Nashville, Carl Dean, I'll say it because it was in the news all the time. He said, I don't want protection bringing me from my house to work. I'm going to use public transportation. He did that for years. No matter what our advice was, he did that for years. And now let's fast forward to when Mitch was mayor. We had a very dangerous guy who was threatening to kill Mitch and his family and Leon and their family. Of course, the police took a much more active role in prescribing what they thought the security package was necessary. Governor Locke's case, somebody went out of his way to try to kill him and went to another state and got guns. So, of course, we did a lot of things more than the ordinary. But the day-to-day stuff, the mayor or the governor, they're going to tell you what they think they need. We're going to think what's the most successful way to do it. And one of the most successful ways to do it is to not tell a guy like Vapi, have a good life, enjoy yourself, go take care of the plants, go take care of the dishes, take care of the cleaning, and then bill us for it.
One thing we didn't talk about, and we will when we come back after the break, is the story that Fox 8 broke back in July about Sergeant Henry Burke making $245,903 in 2024, which is a lot of money, but he worked a lot of time, but is it good to work that much time, or is it feasible, or is it possible or reasonable that he would have worked that much time? And then it goes to overtime and who's signing the sheets, et cetera. Ronald Surpass, our guest, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, 821 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm going to tell this story. This is just my experience having attended the University of Life and working for the Mississippi River Bridge Authority back in the day when it existed. There was somebody that worked there that would consistently turn in 40 hours of work every 2 weeks and 80 hours of overtime. And he was politically connected, and I don't think there's any way that he could have reasonably worked all of those hours, but the timesheets were approved by whoever it was that approved them, and he was paid that money. I'm not saying that's the case here as I talk about this Fox 8 story with Sergeant Henry Burke, to be clear. However, it says that he worked 16 hours longer on 199 different days in 2024. I'm all for everybody working as much as they want. You know, in radio, it happens with remotes and so forth. I get that. But is that safe, Chief, for an officer to work that much? Chief, you there? You got me on mute?
Sorry, yeah. First off, it's not safe at all. When we put the police department on 12-hour shifts once or twice before, the police association screamed of fatigue. So where are they now? They're nowhere to be found. Secondly, it shows that there's no supervision going on here. Now, if that had happened to me on any of the four people that I was appointed by, and I'm sure Cantrell has been distracted by many things, the mayor or the governor would have called me in and said, Chief, why do I employ you? Why do I employ you if you have sergeants and officers that are self-approving or approving one another's friendship overtime? We can't politically defend spending the overtime we need for the hardworking cops when you have these kinds of examples routinely year in and year out. It's as much as a pragmatic problem as it is a supervision problem, as it is a political problem. Like, how do you say we don't have enough money when you got one or two people making that much? And you're right, I don't care how much people make, but who was the sergeant who approved it? Who was the lieutenant who approved it? Who was the captain who approved it? If I was the superintendent, those four or five people would be there telling me, now, how could you do this? Maybe you got a reason, but you better explain it in a way that the common sense New Orleans citizen would say, oh, that makes sense. And guess what? There's no common New Orleans citizen going to say, oh, that makes sense.
To be fair, the Fraternal Order of Police said that the officers singled out by the TV station have done nothing illegal or wrong. They worked extra overtime, paid details. It's a benefit. Crime at a multi-year historical low. WVUE should be complimenting the department and its officers for their hard work.
Oh, man.
Thoughts?
Well, the problem with that is the FOP, I belong to it for the last 45 years. Trying to defend the indefensible always sounds indefensible. The answer is this. Okay, what did he do every day? Was he in a car answering calls for service? Was he out there delivering police service? The chances are probably no. So the question is, not that people shouldn't get paid and not that the police department shouldn't get overtime, but the public does not understand how somebody can double their salary and not have any fatigue, not have any suffering, and be able to provide the same high-quality level of service. Nobody believes it. The FOP can say that till they run out of ink. Nobody believes that.
Was this at the expense of other officers? Was this, as far as you know, I don't know if you know about the situation or not, but could this have been at the expense of other officers where one or two or three or five people are grabbing overtime where other people would have liked to have had it and can't get it?
In departments that have unlimited overtime, which some part of this is what's going on in the NOPD, no, it's really not.
Okay.
I was part of that story when it broke, and the amount of overtime budgeted versus the amount of overtime spent, I did say that the police department in New Orleans was not inconsistent with cities like Baltimore, Philly, D.C., in that you got awarded $5 million, for example, and you spend $15 million. That variance between the two is not necessarily that uncommon in big cities around the country. What it becomes a problem is when you see these examples of people using the overtime, and often they won't be actually attached to calls for service response. Much of it will, but the big, big earners generally don't attach to calls for service.
So what does that mean?
Duty. It means that the FOP arguing that these cops were working
overtime. No, when you say not attached for duty, what does that mean? What are they doing?
I mean, yeah, well, like some administrative stuff. I needed to do some computer programming. I needed to sit around the office and do office work, which is important, but not when you're thinking about answering calls for service with a department that has 900 when it says it should have 1,200 and still celebrates reducing crime. I mean, it's a quagmire that the public just says, can this be? Anyway, the bottom line is, Tommy, when somebody's working that much overtime, you as the leader, like your boss, would say, who approved this and why? If you got a good reason, let's talk about it. If you don't, why did you do it?
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk about Tulane's Future of Energy Forum. It starts today. What's all that about? Right now, we pause for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9. It starts today, the Tulane Future of Energy Forum. Pierre Connor joins us now, Executive Director of the Tulane Energy Institute. Talk about it. Big event and of terribly important to the people here in this area as it relates to the future of energy. Good morning, Pierre. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this event, what it's for and what it hopes to accomplish.
Well, Tommy, it's for really everyone. It's free, it's open to the public, and it's to encourage a really frank conversation about what the future of energy should look like. And I make the point that I think that we're in an inflection point in energy like we haven't seen since the 70s. Everybody should be thinking about it and be able to figure out how to chart this path forward.
Boy, you got my attention saying that, Pierre, because I can remember stories of people waiting in line to get gas where it wasn't available. When you say in the 70s, are you talking about along those lines or oil boom or bust, or what do you mean?
Well, yes, along those lines. And I think what was, at the time, energy permeated everyone's consciousness because we did wait in line. We had to adjust our thermostat, and we had to be conscious about energy. And then, you know, in the intervening 40 years, it really wasn't as much of a focus. But the timing is right, and the place is right. Tommy, you made the point, you know, Louisiana is where we should have this conversation. You know, it's not an either-or conversation. It's an, you know, it's a yes-and conversation. And what you're seeing in Louisiana, of course, is growth and demand. We have an amazing development with the data center in North Louisiana. We're going to be one of the largest exporters of LNG. We have great progress around renewable sources of energy as well, solar. We have a business here that's involved with wind power. So Louisiana is the right place to get the people together with all perspectives to figure out where is the sweet spot. You know, what does it look like?
I'm looking at some of the different things, different events for each day, and I see today you got the energy industry explained, trends, pressure.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
And possibilities, a conversation with Jim Burke, president and CEO of Vistra. What would people gain from that? What would you say are the trends, the pressures, and possibilities when it comes to the energy industry?
Well, there's two aspects. Of course, there's electrons and there's molecules. And the great thing is that, you know, our region has both of those. And Jim is a Tulane graduate and is now the CEO of the largest independent power provider in the country. And it's really tracking well with the demands of power growth that, you know, we haven't seen for decades. And I think people need to really understand the interplay between, you know, is it secure? Is it sustainable? Is it, you know, is it affordable and accessible? And how do you see all of those things come together? That's important.
And another thing I see, workforce opportunities in energy sustainability and environmental rehabilitation, which goes to what you said earlier, which is, it's not either or. It's how to maximize both, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, again, it's how do we, you know, there isn't any singular solution, and you know, there's certainly lots of the historical wrong turns and pitfalls that have occurred in various places, and we have the opportunity right now to really educate the students, for one. I mean, that's our focus here, obviously, at Tulane, but also the public, because we're opening this up to everyone so they understand, you know, what are the issues, and chart that path. You know, get there the right way and the best way that's good for everyone.
And as you mentioned, students, I see there's also a session on students, where you need it most and how to get there. Where's the future for students in the field of energy?
Well, it actually pretty consistently, energy jobs grow faster than the rest of the economy over a reasonable period. Now, I know we all hear about the ups and downs of various segments of the energy industry, but over time, there's a consistent upward trend as we increase the demand for energy. And also, importantly, Tommy, you know, we're fortunate to have EMFRA. The CEO of EMFRA will be here, and we're going to be comprehensive and talk about energy consumption as well. And the EMFRA focuses on the concepts around energy as a service and being efficient in our use of energy. So the jobs are everywhere, frankly.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I see one tomorrow, building the energy system of tomorrow, and also Forging the Future Grid, a dialogue on resilience, flexibility, and AI. We'll talk about all that when we come back. 8:50, 10 till 9. Our guest is Pierre Connor, Executive Director of the Tulane Energy Institute. The Tulane Future of Energy Forum starts today. And Pierre, you said it is open to the public, right?
That's correct. Energyforum.tulane.edu.
All right, we'll take a break. Come back. Pick it up. We come back. 8:51, traffic, WWL. 8:56 and a half, we're talking to Pierre Connor, Executive Director of the Tulane Energy Institute, about the Tulane Energy Forum, that's Future of Energy Forum, that starts today and runs through Friday. Pierre, I got to tell you, man, I'm looking at the lineup that you have here, and it is a very impressive array of people. Walter Isaacson moderating a group at 11 o'clock, the Forging the Future Grid, a dialogue on resilience, flexibility, and AI that includes Tom Kuhn, President and CEO of Global Energy Advisors, Deanna Rodrigue, President and CEO of Energy New Orleans. Tell me what that, if you want to call it a breakout, or that panel is going to discuss.
Well, I think that the discussion about the future of the grid and its resiliency, its reliability, these things are becoming more and more important to all of us. The president of Entergy New Orleans, Ms. Rodriguez, as well as, you know, her boss, the CEO of Entergy Corporation, mm-hmm. here will be, talking about how do we meet this growing demand for electricity that we haven't seen for decades. And then, it's an interesting question about AI, Tommy. You know, does AI make us more efficient? Can we use that tool to allow us to be more conscious in our use of energy? But yet, of course, it's a tremendous demand for power, as we're seeing, energy supply power for that unique facility being built in North Louisiana. So I think there's an opportunity for us all to understand how we could use those tools and how we can make them more efficient and, as well, of course, make sure it's all affordable to everyone.
And then Friday, a global energy magnate, what LNG reveals about Louisiana's advantage. I live in Plaquemines, so that is of intense interest to me. What is Louisiana's advantage when it comes to LNG?
Well, that's a great point, Tommy. They like to say that all roads lead to Rome, mm-hmm. but the reality is all pipelines lead to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So we have the infrastructure to move the molecules. We also have access to, higher pressure, drier natural gas in North Louisiana, and we have our coastline. So we just need to make sure that we're smart about taking advantage of all those things and supplying, frankly, places that want affordable, lower emissions energy by the use of our LNG that we export. Louisiana needs to be very thoughtful about that, and there's great opportunities for us as a result.
I'm going to tell you, it's an impressive array that you put together over the next 3 days, and there's something there literally for everyone. I would suggest you go to, is it energyforum.tulane.edu, and you can register first and get your credentials. It's free, is that right, to the public?
That's right. We might have, nearly 1,500 people have registered, but I think there'll be a lot of good conversations in the sessions as well as on the sidelines.
And it's on the campus, right?
That is correct, Tommy.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. And again, good luck. That's an impressive array. We'll take a break, come back, talk about college sports. All right, 9:15. If you have watched any college sports, you're seeing a guy doing a commercial about the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961, and you're saying, what now? Well, Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, has a story up at extrapointsmb.com talking about it, and we thought we'd talk to him about it as well. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me who this guy is and what's this all about.
Sure. So the gentleman that you're seeing on these commercials is a fellow named Cody Campbell. Campbell was a former offensive lineman at Texas Tech. He is the current Board of Regents chair for the university, and also happens to be a billionaire who made his money in the oil and gas industry in West Texas. Campbell is somebody who has become significantly involved in legislative efforts to regulate college sports. He was one of the guys tied to President Trump's commission on college athletics, mm-hmm. And has been very vocal in wanting to change federal law to accommodate where college sports is going right now.
So what is the Broadcasting Act of 1961, a Sports Broadcasting Act, that for anybody that was around that may not remember it, not because Lord knows I don't know anything about it.
And this was something I vaguely remember from college, and it was not typically what I'm thinking about when I'm watching football on a mm-hmm. Saturday. But what this law allowed was for the NFL and then any other professional sports league to sell their TV rights as a collective unit rather than individual teams. Prior to 61, the Giants might have their own TV deal, and the Eagles and the Packers might have their own. But the CBS couldn't sell a nationwide deal with the entire NFL. That was viewed as collusion. That was an antitrust violation.
Against the stations, right? Against the affiliates by the network. Do I understand that right?
Against the NFL.
Against the NFL.
The federal judge viewed you can't. The Packers and the Cowboys and the Colts are all competing against each other. How can you pool all of their broadcast rights together? That's
gotcha.
Price fixing.
Okay.
So you have right. So then the law changes, and the very narrow exemption for just pro sports leagues, which has helped all of the pro sports leagues make a lot of money. They make much more money selling broadcast rights as a totality rather mm-hmm. than individually. And it also had some special rules that were meant to protect high school and college football. The law says that the NFL can't have games on Fridays during the middle of September, through the middle of December, if the game's anywhere near a high school or a college. Mm-hmm. It's meant to kind of say Friday's high school, Saturday's college, Sunday's the NFL. And that worked for a while, but I think it's pretty clear that's not really terribly effective legislation now.
Yeah, we had a Friday night game, so what are they, just blatantly violating the law?
Well, one of the things the NFL can do now is you could play a game in, say, Brazil or mm-hmm. Germany. And São Paulo is not 75 miles from any American high school program. Because the NFL has become so popular and we have broader distribution channels, you can still have that. You'll still be on national television. The game's just not in the United States. And there are a couple of other exceptions around Black Friday or some of these other issues here. But like this bill was written not just before streaming, but really before cable television. Like the idea of a network being able to broadcast more than one football game on a day was not something that was really a thing in 1960. It's very much a thing now.
What does that have to do with college sports, as Cody Campbell is talking about?
This is a good question. And I would agree with Campbell here, and I think many other reporters would too, when he says, look, current financial model in college sports is facing tremendous pressure. You and I have talked about this too, between having to pay money directly to players, between labor and construction costs increasing, a lot of high-end facilities, all these other issues, and every single school is looking for more revenue. And what Campbell is concerned about is, hey, if we don't find a way to dramatically grow that revenue, the thing that's going to get cut are going to be women's and Olympic sports, which is something that is already happening at the FCS and 1AAA level.
And you and I have discussed that already.
We have. Yep. So his proposed solution is, hey, what if instead of having an SEC television deal and a Big Ten television deal and a Sun Belt deal and a Southland Conference deal, colleges were allowed to package all of those things together, just like they did before 1984 at the NCAA, and sell one television package.
Go back to 1984, because at that point, there were not different conferences, and different conferences couldn't have their own deals.
The way that it used to work, and I think some of your listeners here might remember this, mm-hmm. is it used to be the NCAA controlled all of the television money. There was no SEC television deal or Pac-8 TV deal.
Or Notre Dame, for example.
Yeah. And the NCAA decided how often you were on television and what you're going to watch, and that might mean you were watching a 1AAA game that day. In 1984, Oklahoma and Georgia sued and won at the Supreme Court. It's called the Board of Regents v. Oklahoma. And that Supreme Court decision said the NCAA couldn't control all of these things. That was an antitrust violation. It wasn't part of the Sports Broadcasting Act. And so conferences could set their own deals. In the short term, that led to everyone making less money. In the medium term, it led to all the conferences making a lot more money, exploded money within college sports. And now Campbell and a couple of other conference commissioners are saying, you know, I think we would make more money and we would get rid of this incentive to have cross-country conference realignment if we were all part of one TV deal. And in order for that to happen, we need an antitrust exemption, and that requires us to amend the SBA.
I'm trying to stay up with you, Matt. I'm trying to see if one amends that and goes back to the other one. But so they want to go back to 1984 or
essentially a version of that. What was happening before 84, the government said was illegal. In order to go back to that system, where one unit controls all of the TV and sells it, you need a change in the law. 84 said one unit is an antitrust violation. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is allowed to do it because they have an exemption written into the Sports Broadcasting Act. But because college sports technically aren't professional, they're not included. So that is what Campbell wants. He wants to be able to combine the Big 12 and the ACC and the SEC and the Big 10 TV contracts and have one gigantic partnership distributes the money rather than five or six different deals.
So how is that going to change conference alignments or put them back to where they were?
And what Campbell or somebody else that believes in this proposal would say, there's no reason for Cal to be playing an ACC schedule if Cal is going to make the same television money whether they no matter what. Cal moves to the ACC because the Pac-12 dissolves and because they need a place to be able to play and to have this certain kind of distribution. So if everyone's part of the same deal and you had a central body that can make some of these scheduling decisions, it would be much easier to say, okay, now let's redraw these things where it either lines up more with geography or with history. So then we're not traveling 2,000 miles away to go play a random conference game that we can't sell tickets to. Let's move back to alignment.
Where do the TV networks and the conferences stand on this?
Well, it depends on the conference, right? Mm-hmm. If you are a conference that is not at the top of the food chain right now, you're probably excited by this. You know, one of the loudest proponents of this kind of arrangement is Tim Pernetti, who's the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily think he's wrong from his position, but yeah, of course, if I had a league with Temple and ECU and UTSA, I would love to bundle with people that have more attractive rights, because it's going to be harder and harder for me as the American to get a worthwhile TV package moving forward, especially if I lose a school or two. If you're the Big Ten and the SEC, you hate this idea because you already have a significant financial and competitive advantage. If you are suddenly merging your television package with Texas Tech and Wake Forest, you lose that. You no longer have preferred governance power compared to everybody else. There's a reason that all these pro sports did this back in the early 60s, before the gap between the rich and the poor clubs was so massive. It would be very difficult to get this approved now.
So is there support for this in Congress or not? Or is he just making some noise?
No, it's a good question. And based on my reporting right now, this is not an issue that has captured a lot of congressional attention. And I think there's a good reason for that, right? There's a lot of things going on in this country right now. Mm. And revisiting
in the world.
70-year-old in the world, yeah. If you're in the Louisiana 2nd District or 3rd District, I don't think revisiting a 70-year-old broadcast law is the number one thing on your agenda. It becomes that way when donors and then later voters start pushing for it. If one guy who's worth a couple billion dollars starts putting commercials, then you start thinking about it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of lawmakers over the last decade, Republicans and Democrats, that have suggested changing this law, in part because of wanting to revisit the legal requirements around blackouts. And that may very well be something that gets adjusted. But the bulk of Campbell's plan is more popular right now with Campbell and a few college sports executives than it is in Congress or even with the broadcast networks.
All right, so let's go back to Olympic sports, because part of what he said was that it would affect Olympic sports and women's sports. How does that how do we get back to there? Because we've still got name, image, and likeness, right? And we still got salary caps or not?
Yeah, and this is, I wrote about this in the story too. I think this is where I would significantly disagree with Mr. Campbell, mm-hmm. and I'm open to being persuaded otherwise, and still going to report this out. His theory is that if everyone's operating budget jumps by $15, $20, $25 million, then there won't be a need to cut women's tennis, because there will be enough money to pay for women's tennis, pay those coaches, pay those facilities, and still
say that part again, Matt.
Yeah, Campbell believes if all the universities get an extra $20 million from your television deal.
How are you defining all the universities, and where is that money coming from?
Sure. So we'll define all the universities as Division I FBS football playing institutions,
okay.
Schools that would be a part of this unified television deal, hypothetical unified television.
So Northwestern deal. State, McNeese? No, because that's not FBS.
So no, because they're FCS.
All right,
that would be a different television.
Gotcha. Okay.
But this
FBS
would include, so Monroe, Tulane, Lafayette, La Tech.
Okay.
So these institutions, according to Campbell, are going to make a lot more money from television, because right now, if you're in CUSA, you might get $4.5 million from ESPN Plus. And in this hypothetical new contract that brings in everybody, suddenly that check might become $20 million, $18 million, $30 million, because the total value of the deal would be so much larger. So his thinking is, if everybody gets this much larger television check, they will have enough money to fund athlete revenue sharing that's going to go to mostly the football and men's basketball, and still pay the tennis coach, still pay to keep the swimming pool operating, and not have to cut anything. I don't think that is very realistic, but I understand why he would think that.
So, first of all, where's the money coming from?
The money hypothetically here is coming from ESPN, or it's coming from whoever buys the rights to this gigantic new football television package, whether that's Amazon or Google or anybody else, the entity that is paying the rights fees.
All right, and the other question I have is, it would seem like now the athletes are following the money, so while this guy might, Cody, whatever his name is, Campbell, might be interested in Texas Tech, the athletes are following the money, so how is that affecting the Olympic teams, unless Olympic sports, some of the like maybe track and field or tennis or, I don't know, maybe golf, whatever, some Olympic sports aren't being funded at the big university level? Is that what's going on?
That is what's happening. So the big universities, the Power Four, none of them have really dropped an Olympic sport entirely after the House settlement. Mm. But many of them have cut scholarships and cut operational spending for those programs. So I can give an example. At my alma mater, Ohio State has a very successful men's volleyball and men's gymnastics program. Mm-hmm. They compete for national championships. They've sent players to the Olympics. Those programs still exist, but they're not giving scholarships anymore, and their operational budgets have been slashed. So Ohio State then has the money to give more scholarship aid and more infrastructure spending to football and women's basketball and a few other sports. What Campbell is saying is, hey, if Ohio State suddenly got an extra check for $15 million, they could afford to still give scholarships for men's volleyball and still maintain all of the football spending that they're currently doing. That is his hope.
So is there any credence to the fact that, from the university's standpoint, if somebody wants to pursue an Olympic dream of volleyball, be it on the men's side or women's side, at the Ohio State University, which has a noted program, and that's their best chance for success, that they're just going to foot the tuition themselves? Or is there any evidence other than anecdotal that would indicate, well, these Olympians would not exist but for scholarships? You see where I'm going
with
that?
I do. And I was, part of this is we need data, right?
Right.
I think the unpleasant reality is that Ohio State is prepared to make the sacrifice of never producing another male volleyball Olympian or never winning another men's volleyball national title if it means that they save $600,000 that they can reallocate somewhere else. Like, we'll have the team, but it will functionally be a Division III team. And there's a surprising number of Power Four Olympic sports that operate under that model.
So let me look at it the other way, and that is, then are there openings for schools to develop big volleyball programs, big swimming programs, big other Olympic sports programs, and the other schools have the football, the Ohio States have the football, but those other schools have the Olympic programs because that's where the athletes know they can be trained and develop?
I think that's entirely possible. And I can tell you that right now in some sports, there are schools that are making that bet. You know, to zoom out for a little bit about for men's volleyball specifically, the schools that have not cut spending and have been very successful and have decided it's cheaper and easier for us to compete there would be a school like Hawaii, mm-hmm. a school like UC Irvine or Long Beach. And over time, that may end up happening. Part of the challenge is not just about who's going to offer me scholarships, but who has facilities, who has a high level coach, and who can get me games against other high quality teams to prepare me for this. And over a long enough time period, sure, we may have a world where the Olympic pipeline in gymnastics and swimming and track shifts more towards the G5 or to places that think that they have a competitive advantage. But you can be the greatest swim team in the country right now. The school doesn't make any money. No one's really selling tickets to watch swimming. So there's still going to be this major incentive, in my opinion, to focus on football and men's basketball, even if you're way more likely to win a championship or send someone to the Olympics in a different sport.
It seems like the easiest answer to this is for the government to sponsor the Olympic teams, as happens in other countries. Yes or no?
I think so. There's a reason why that's what everyone else does. The exact way the government funds them is different in lots of different countries. Mm-hmm. There are South American, European countries where that sponsorship comes through the military, and the military operates sporting academies. There are some places where there's a federal minister of sport, and essentially the equivalent of U.S. soccer is just like completely funded by the government, and they sponsor these things to great success. Our country has decided not to do that. There's very, very little federal funding for Olympic sports. The entities that have been subsidizing that have been universities. And that model is very much under threat. One way you could fix that is to have the government do it. Another way you could potentially fix it is to just make everybody a lot more money and maybe you make them spend some of that money on Olympic sports. Probably third or other ways.
I know you have to go, Matt. I appreciate your time. If, you know, maybe instead of donating $3, whatever it is, on your tax return to the presidential election, because Lord knows there's enough money chasing that, maybe you donate it to the Olympic team, right?
And, well, you could do something like that, too. A really popular idea in Congress and in academic circles right now is to take, 3% tax on sports gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that somebody, lays down the money line on the Vikings or something, we kick $4 of that and kick it to the U.S. Olympic Committee. I think there's ways of doing it without necessarily creating a new department or a new level of tax. I think this is the kind of conversation that should be happening in Congress more than what should we be doing about NIL, because this is a space where I think the government actually can't help.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. You can go to extrapoints.com and find out more. If you want to subscribe, there's also a free version. We'll take a break, come back. It's about a year ago that St. Charles Parish was rocked by Hurricane Francine. I think we'll talk with Matt Jewell about that and more when we return on WWL 934 Traffic First. 941, 19 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, making our way through this Wednesday morning. Matt Jewell joins us now, president of St. Charles Parish. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing good, Tommy. Thanks for having me this morning.
Thanks for taking the time. I know you're a policy guy. Let's talk about rolling back millages to a 30-year low. That doesn't happen often, does it?
No, we're really proud of the work that we've been able to do over the past 5 years. Not only myself, our assessor, the sheriff, our school district, and all the other taxing bodies in St. Charles Parish. For the past 5 years, we've taken the opportunity as the tax roll grows, as the parish grows in value, to roll that millage rate down. And we've been able to cut over 17 mils from our all-time high of about 119 mils down to, 100 mils and change. And we want to keep that momentum going forward.
So the easiest thing in the world would have been to keep the millage where it is and just spend the money that you had, right? I mean, that's what some governments would do, but that's not the way you look at it.
No, look, if you look at how much money we've saved the taxpayers in the parish over the last 5 years, it's $100+ million that has stayed in the economy. And we believe that private citizens, private businesses know how to spend that money best, better than government. And we know how easy it is. We see it at the federal level. When they get more money, they figure out a way to spend it. And we want to make sure that we are staying fiscally accountable to our people, but also keeping the millage rate at a responsible level that allows us to continue to providing the really high quality services that we have in St. Charles Parish.
How did you manage to do that and not cut services?
Well, so as the parish has grown, we've reduced the millage rates. We've done it in a way that allows us to keep the revenue somewhat stable and account for inflation. As we know, after 2020, inflation hit everybody. It hits parish governments and taxing authorities, sometimes unequally. Sometimes we see a little bit more of an inflation depending on the type of work we're doing, like construction. So we've been able to do it to where we've maintained, kind of our revenues, but rolled back enough to be able to start giving relief to our residents. And as we saw after COVID, the amount of increase in value in residential properties and businesses across the nation, we knew we had to do something to really help kind of give some relief. I know, I can't control insurance rates on homeowners insurance, but we can work with our taxing bodies to give relief on this side. So that's what we're doing, and we're committed to continuing to rolling that back.
I'm looking at this press release. 5 consecutive years, St. Charles Parish School Board's made decisions that both eased the burdens on taxpayers and upheld the excellence of the school system. Do you know what those actions were?
Yeah, so we issued a joint press release because the 3 major taxing bodies, the parish, the school board, and the sheriff's office, have all worked very collaboratively to be able to make these reductions together. So that reduction in over 17 mils of property tax has been the collective work of all of our taxing bodies. And we've worked really closely with our assessor, Tab Troxler, who has helped us, analyze these numbers and figure out what we can do, what we can't do, and get this down. And look, it's a over 30-year low. It hasn't been this low since 1992. Like I said, we're committed to keeping that going. We think it's a great thing to be able to do this.
I'm trying to understand this, Matt. I'm not the policy guy that you are, but the budgets have remained the same, and this is because of increased revenue from growth, or the budgets have decreased, like when it comes to school board, sheriff, et cetera?
Sure. The growth came from the overall millage or the overall value of the parish. So as new companies have invested, as you know, St. Charles Parish is very industrial heavy. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a lot of investment in the industries within St. Charles Parish. We have a lot of industries looking to come to St. Charles Parish, and we believe that's because coming to St. Charles Parish, when you look regionally at all the other parishes, we have the lowest millage rate in the entire region now, whereas we used to be on somewhat of the same level as parishes like St. John and Lafourche and Jefferson. Now we are 20% below those parishes. So not only is it the investment of existing companies and industries here, it's also the expiration of tax exemptions from some of those same industries. So you would see under the expiration of those tax exemptions a windfall to the parish. So instead of taking that windfall through all these through all of our taxing bodies and figuring out ways to spend it, we've said let's be fiscally accountable to the residents and give that money back, keep it in the economy for people to make those investments themselves, and let's try to keep what we're doing here stable and but being able to grow into the future. So we look at it every year and we make adjustments each year.
So is it a point of carefully managing the resources when it comes to school board? Did they cut the budget, or is the budget the same and it just, you can roll the millage back because more's coming in?
So I think, yeah, more's coming in, so they're able to cut the budget. I think their budget has remained somewhat flat. I think they actually did see a reduction in revenue this past year. So they've actually gone further and been able to cut more revenue than they would have had last year. So, yes, I mean, if you look at it, they have a very healthy budget. I know they work very closely with us. We have done a lot with getting federal grants. We've done a lot with getting state money, money from CPRA to help us do our projects to stretch them further. And that has really, resulted in a lot of success when it comes to that.
I might remember Hurricane Francine. I don't know, but here's the deal, Matt. Like you, a hurricane, you know, is when we work, so it's just a blur of mattresses and sleeping on the floor and working. And the Francine got knocked out by the snowstorm because I was here for that. But tell me about Francine and what it did a year ago to St. Charles Parish.
Yeah, Francine kind of had a similar path for us as Hurricane Ida. So when it got onto land right out, like when it was getting over Lafourche Parish, yeah, it actually stalled. And because of the direction these storms turn, they tend to wobble eastward. That caused the storm to wobble towards St. Charles Parish. And as it stalled, it dumped about 9 inches of rain on us in about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So we had some flooding from that storm. It was a bad storm. We lost power and, you know, we were able to recover quickly. Obviously it was not Hurricane Ida. But look, we have some great investment that's happened in St. Charles Parish when it comes to, just storm protection, whether it's levee protection or drainage, over $100 million in the last 5 years that I've been in office towards flood protection. And we've seen a significant reduction in the amount of homes that have flooded. And we have great data going back about 20 or 30 years with similar rain events. And so we're able to see what has been working and where we still need to put that money in. But, you know, just recently we broke ground on two pump stations for the community of Muntz on the west side of St. Charles Parish. Two pump stations under construction simultaneously. That's a $33 million investment in that community and is going to provide permanent pumping capacity. So a lot of great stuff happening. A lot of the stuff that we saw in Francine where we had water standing is not going to happen in the future because of the investments we're making. And we're proud to be able to do that all while lowering that millage rate to a 30-year low.
Real quick, Matt, you got to look 5-10 years down the line. I know you were able to roll it back, but the parish has enough reserve. Should something happen again, or are you in a position where you would have to roll it forward again? You understand what I'm saying? As a leader, I'm just wondering how you navigate those waters.
No, that's a great question, and we always are looking at that and always analyzing, you know, future growth. And I think that we are in a healthy position right now. You know, every year we have a balanced budget. We mandate a balanced budget. And that's what we present to our parish council every year. So we don't ever get ourselves overly in debt, and have to tie up all that money that can go towards operating or capital improvements towards debt service. But we believe with the new investments on the horizon that are coming to St. Charles Parish, and that the fact that we get to analyze this millage rate each year, that's going to allow us to be able to stay in a healthy position moving forward.
And so, we got 60 seconds. Speak to those new things coming to St. Charles Parish, please.
Well, we have a couple of industries looking to come here. You know, blue ammonia, which is going to be the next generation of fuel source. We're in the process of talking to a steel company that wants to manufacture steel here along the river in St. Charles Parish. We're going to be getting some new electrical generation to support projects like Meta coming to industrial zones in St. Charles Parish. So a lot of good stuff on the horizon. And we believe because we have that low millage rate that people are going to want to move here. We're going to have businesses that are going to want to move here because when you're looking at the region, we're 20% lower right off the top.
Seems to me like you're getting it done. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tommy.
You bet. Matt Jewell, president of St. Charles Parish. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar-Free. First-round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.